Hey, Phoenix, tired of battling the mighty pollen? We've got your back. Aspire Allergy and Sinus offers lasting allergy relief so you can chuck those temporary fixes and savor that sweet, sweet taste of victory over pollen. With same-day results and tailor-made treatment plans, we've turned the tables on allergies. Aspire patients enjoy relief that lasts for years. Schedule your appointment today at AspireAllergy.com. Turn your daily sneeze-a-thon into a breeze with Aspire Allergy and Sinus. Go to AspireAllergy.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host. I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I get to sit and chat with Mick Talbot. Mick Talbot of the Style Council, Dexys, Merton Parker's, Gene. Aside from obviously the incredible work that, you know, everybody knows Mick for doing with Paul Weller in the Style Council, Mick's involvement in the music industry is far and wide, and we touch on a lot of it during this podcast, and we also obviously talk about some great records. It was a real privilege. I'm a bit of a Style Council uber freak fan, and so I tried to keep a lid on it, and I think I held it down enough not to come across as a real fanboy, and he's just a really, really nice fella, so you're in for a treat on today's episode. Firstly, a few thanks. I'd like to thank our previous guest Mark Baxter, firstly, because Bax introduced me to Mick, so thanks loads for that, and obviously this has come about through Bax working with Mick on the forthcoming Style Council documentary film that's coming out very, very, very soon, so keep one eye peeled for that one. And just some other thanks. Thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. And if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track podcast, then once you finish listening to this great natter I have with Mick, then why not go and have a look in the archives? You can listen to me speaking to Mark Baxter. You can listen to me speaking to Steve Craddock, Eddie Piller, The Milk. And then also you can hear me chatting to actors and actresses such as Maxine Peake, Amanda Abington. Oh gosh, the list goes on. And there's about 150 episodes now of all your faves, just chatting to every kind of possible creative, you know, actors, DJs, producers, comedians. Go and have a rummage in the archives, and I'm sure you'll find some stuff there that will tickle your fancy. Okay, that's enough waffle from me. Let's get on with today's episode. It gives me great delight to say, please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Mick Talbot.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Right, we are recording. Sitting opposite me today via the means of Zoom, Mick Talbot, hello.
Hi, how you doing, Stu? All right?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. We've just had a quick chat that I'm blessed that you've managed to work out Zoom. You're not too good with the tech stuff, no?
No, I'm not. My wife had to go out, so Mission Control was sort of like not a bit understaffed at the moment, but thankfully it looks all right to me.
Brilliant. Before we get on with the playlist, Mick, I'm just interested to know, like, how you found the last sort of 6 months of life in the UK and the sort of situation that we're in, both, you know, as a musician, creative, and as a human.
Well, I try and look on the bright side. It could be worse. It's an unusual thing, but it makes you reflect on what you truly value in your personal life and your professional life. It is frustrating, particularly from a professional point of view. And in my game, there's fewer and fewer chances to do what I call proper recording. But on paper, I had about 5 or 6 albums that I would have been doing in that kind of last 7 months. And very fortunate to get involved with an independent label that were quite busy with a lot of different projects. And some of them were going to be, 2 of those were going to be recorded abroad at residential studios, which always ups the fun element, really. You know, you create your own little holiday camp for musicians, and that you know, that's a tantalizing prospect if it comes back. But people are having to find other ways of doing things. I mean, I'm kind of quite old school, and I like the community aspects of making music. So my favorite thing is to have 4 people in the room playing at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's all very well. Yeah, you can do remote stuff, and even someone as inept as me, I have participated in an online festival where I played a couple of things down the phone, and they come out the other end, and that was all right. But it makes you treasure things that you took for granted in your personal life and your professional life. But also, it's an opportunity for me as a musician to get back into things that I quite liked. And like I said, because those things got put on the back burner after about the first month, I thought, I've got demos for about 3 of these albums, but now I know them too well. I've sort of rinsed them inside out. I've got about 4 or 5 great ideas for everything, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So leave that. Go back to what first enchanted you about music. So it's a kind of, it's a funny time, but it's right for sort of reflection, you know. I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on that I'm sort of trying to promote from my little cocoon that are quite nostalgic and reflective. And I'm not normally like that, but it seems like a good time to do it, you know. I mean, we weren't to know that all this was going to kick off, but, you know. It makes you think, oh, perhaps it's all for a reason, you know.
Yeah, of
and
course.
It could be worse, you know.
Let's talk records, Mick.
Okay.
Track 1. What's the song with the greatest ever intro?
Well, I thought about a few for this, but I think I've settled with my first thought was It's A Man's, Man's, Man's World by James Brown.
What a shout. What a great shout. I've never considered that.
It's not very long, but it's very dramatic and dynamic, and it kind of sets it up. And it's nice to hear James Brown singing. He's a great singer. It's not just about Take Me to the Bridge and sounding like you're being sick in a bucket half the time and screaming. There's all of that and all the funk stuff. But his early stuff, he's a really good singer, and I think he really sings that lovely. And the intro is sort of just, I don't know, it's so dynamic. Well, I had a few other things that I thought about, but
go on, framing. You can have some honourable mentions, mate.
You're okay. They both concern rain, which we've had a lot lately. I like Walking in the Rain with the one that I love by Love Unlimited.
Yep.
Because that sounds like a film to me. There's like quite a lot of dialogue along with all the kind of weather effects and then the orchestration. That's really nice. And the other one is In the Rain by the Dramatics, which got that big sort of like dub guitar thing at the front, which is really kind of, I don't know, I've got a thing about rain, you know. It's a lovely metaphor.
Since the sort of the early days of you know, your sort of introduction into music and songwriting through to, you know, as you're saying, like still sort of working on the demos that you got at the moment and the projects that you had in place before this situation happened. How have you seen the changes in music, and has that affected your songwriting and the way that you approach songwriting and potentially just, you know, intros as well, insofar as the way that people would have listened to music, say back in the days, the Style Council would have been going out, buying a piece of vinyl or a cassette or whatever, coming home and listening to it, and, you know, probably being able to afford 1 album a week. Whereas nowadays, you've got every single possible record you could ever want on your phone, on your computer, whatever. So there's so much more distraction. So we're seeing with a lot of pop music, the structures of it, sort of, there's no fat on the bone anymore. It's like straight in with the chorus and you know, because they're trying to hook you. I just wonder, you know, how you've seen them changes over the years and if it's had any sort of effect on the sort of music that how you approach songwriting.
Yeah, I don't know that it necessarily changed the way I approach things, but I mean, as a freelance kind of session guy, I've worked on stuff recently where somebody said to me, Radio 2, like a thing that they call episodic mixes, I think they called it, so that there's something new happening every 8 bars or something. And I just sort of thought, do you really sit down and write a song and think, oh, I'm going to be bored in about sort of 15 seconds, so I need to do something else. I mean, if that's a natural progression for what you're doing,
yeah.
You know, I know Willie Mitchell, a producer that I love from the old days, like did Al Green and Ann Peebles and stuff like that. He had a theory like singles should be like you get to the top of the mountain and then you fade, you know. So, and also, you know, donkey's years back, I've worked with producers when I was very young and naive, and they've said, put the chorus up the front. They've edited it, and sometimes they've got a point, you know. It's like, get them with the hook straight away. I think, like, what you're talking about as well, I can see it in films and promo things as well. People's patience. They want instant sort of gratification. They can't have something that builds. I mean, it's like taking someone to a theatre or something who's sort of never been there, and you just think, hang on, the way this works, it's got three acts, right? And there's and they just go, well, how boring. Mm. It's like, oh, you know, a film wouldn't be like that. But it's like, it's a kind of thing. It's got a means. And I still like the format of an LP, especially if it's been made as a collection of songs that kind of work together. But I think we're kind of losing a bit of that. At the same time, I think the DJ thing, I can remember working with a lot of DJs and looking through their records and seeing an album that I know and just going, do you know, do you know that track? And they go, there's only one track on it because that's the one I play when I'm out. Do you know what I mean? And that's all they knew. They'd never played the album. I was just astonished with that.
Yeah.
I just thought, you've never played the album. Went, no, the one with the break on it is the one that sort of like gets the floor, and you think, yeah, well, that's fair enough, yeah. But I mean, it's a really good album,
yeah.
And actually, if you like what you think is the strongest track, you'll probably be engaged with some of the other stuff as well because it's the same band. But it depends where you're coming in on it. So I think there's always been a bit of that, but it's like you're right. People's patience levels are just sort of, I don't know,
Well, what you said there about sort of DJ culture of, you know, that they only want the track that's got the break for the dance floor. But I guess nowadays, it's, you know, I speak to lots of, you know, musicians on here, and I always sort of say, like, when you're making albums now, do you still make them albums as a body of work, as a piece of art, you know, or are you aware that people, you know, a lot of people's buying and listening habits now are, I'll go on iTunes and I'll just buy that one I like off the album. You know.
Yeah, I think you're aware people are like that, but if you're sort of old and ancient enough, then you still work in the traditions that sort of suit you, and you think, well, people can cherry pick, and that's fine, you know. It doesn't concern me. I mean, there are sort of like little kind of holes in this set network, though, because I was looking for a B-side, and I couldn't find the 7-inch, and I thought I had it in a box in my loft, and I couldn't find it, and I wanted to hear this B-side. And I didn't do a lot of fishing around, but I went on Spotify and they didn't have it. And it's just like, oh, the B-side doesn't exist. You've got the A-side, but the B-side doesn't exist. Yeah. Sometimes there's some real treasures on B-sides, and quite often they don't make it onto the album either. So they're like a kind of little secret world. And
yeah.
There's lots of treasures to be found there. And I just thought, oh, that's a shame, isn't it? They've got like all this fella's A-sides, but they haven't got this B-side. And I just thought,
but that situation, Mick, to me, I love that, because that means that if you want that, you've got to go and find it. You've got to go and either root through your loft till you do find it, or go online and find a record store or whatever, or go down your local record shop and buy it. And for me, that's the thing. And I know we're sounding like a pair of granddads here, but it is the thing I like, is the fact that the payoff, you get the payoff, but the journey's part of it as well, you know, going to that record shop and getting it, and then you really, because you can't just get it like that, you've got to go and find it. And then I think it does. It is that little gem moment of like, well, look, I had to go and get that. And it's tangible. It's in my hand now.
Well, I've got a lot to thank B-Sides for, because when I worked, first of all, with Paul Weller, we used to talk about records and he'd just go, do you know the B-side? And we used to have this sort of almost like B-side competition for sort of like quite big tracks, but a lot of people don't bother with the B-sides. And you just, you talked about them. And funny enough, like the first band I was in, Paul got given a copy of the single and he didn't like it, but he listened to the B-side. And on the B-side, I'm playing a piano solo. And that's what first engaged him with what I did. He went, I didn't like that single, but I listened to the B-side and I want you to do something like that with me.
Wonderful.
So those 20 seconds, a little, you know, throwaway electric piano break, it just sort of, I've got a lot to thank that for, you know.
Yeah. And had he gone on Spotify, probably wouldn't have found it.
I don't think that existed then. We're going back a long way. We're going back to when I went to school with Jesus.
Track two, Mick. The first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you?
Well, I first thought about things that bring you sort of sorrow, but that's not the only emotion in the world. But I think it's like elation and exuberance. When I was really young, I think it's probably a bit of a cliche from people of my age group, but the Beatles, She Loves You.
Yeah.
Just the first time we heard that, and I, you know, I'm old enough to remember the fateful Royal Command performance where Lennon did his thing about if you're in the cheap seats, clap, and if you're in the posh seats, rattle your jewellery and stuff like that. I mean, I can't remember him saying that at the time. I can just remember one of the tunes was She Loves You, and that had the chorus at the front, and it just got you straight away. Mm. There's something about repeating words three times, you know. Amy Winehouse has done it. No, no, no. You know, it's just something, you get it in that reggae thing. No, no, no. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Something about that, just to a kid of four or five, it just grabs you. And there was an excitement about the Beatles then, you know, seeing them in real time coming out at the time. It's just, as young as I was, I understood that it was something special, you know. Mm. And I like the fact that my mum and dad liked them as well, you know.
The rawness when you listen back to them early Beatles releases now, it's just incredible, isn't it? The energy as well. I mean, She Loves You.
It's easy to overlook because, you know, we've all probably suffered by overexposure and, you know, what you think of it. But when you do hear, I don't know, it's just, that's just a sort of honest answer. That's what's good about these questions. They're not necessarily like seven records that I put on all the time.
Yeah.
But they are steered by your life, you know, and what sort of, you know, hits you at the moment.
You mentioned that you know, your parents liked the Beatles as well. So, you know, in the sort of formative years, Mick, was there sort of records on at home and stuff?
Yeah, well, I would say my mum liked them more. My mum was into what was happening there. I think her favourite group at the time were the Searchers, another band from Liverpool, who Paul McCartney always used to say were good. I think they were quite a seminal band in the kind of whole American scene. They influenced the Byrds and people like that. So in turn, that would have like led on to people like Johnny Marr and lots of things. You know, they were real 12-string merchants. So my mum liked a lot of that sort of stuff, but she also liked a lot of early Motown. She was listening to a lot of the pirate radio stations that were around. And so we used to hear a lot of that. But my dad was more into modern jazz, but he could understand the appeal of certain things. But I got to understand my dad's music a bit more when I was a bit older and made a connection between certain modern jazz and certain soul things, you know, the roots being common, blues and gospel and stuff, you know. So, yeah, they were both into music.
What about playing? How did that come about? Was there a piano at home?
Yeah, my nan lived with us, and she played the piano by ear, and she couldn't explain how she did it. And so that lent it a certain sort of magic to me when I was really, really little. And I used to like sitting there. I used to sit by the piano stool like a little dog by her feet, listening to her and just almost falling asleep because I just thought, how do you do it? And I tried to get her to show me, and she tried to show me things. She went, I don't know. It's sort of, I don't know how I do it, but I can show you some things, you know. So that sort of drew me in. She actually got me lessons, which I just hated, but it kind of took me a bit further, and I stuck with them for a little while because she could see that I was keen. But and my dad could play the piano a bit, but he's a bit better on guitar, really, you know. But so, yeah, through that side of the family, really, and my nan, you know.
And where was this, Mick? Where was home then?
Well, I lived in Tooting, which is in the borough of Wandsworth in South London, till I was about six or seven, and then we moved to South Wimbledon, Merton, that area. So only three stops down the Northern Line, just where sort of southwest London blurs into the Surrey.
Yeah. Good place to grow up?
Yeah, it was all right. It was nice, you know. I mean, you know, fortunate as a in my late teens, there were quite a lot of pubs along that Northern Line stretch. So between the Malden and the Elephant, there were a lot of pubs, and I used to go around them with my mate and just say, we're in a band, can we play? What's your worst night? Let us play. You know, and there were quite a lot, you know. You could do that regularly, ping-pong up and down that first bit of the Northern Line, and a lot of pubs where you could play, so it was good.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, well, let's go back for a moment and we'll pick back up on that. But for track three, Mick, I want to know the song that reminds you of your time at school.
The track that reminds me of time at school, the one I've gone for is Band of Gold by Freda Payne. Because I just went to a new school when that came out, and that was number one for over a month. I think I remember hearing it late summer, and then by the time we went to school in September, I'm sure it was number one till October. It was just up there for ages, you know, and it just, it really had something, you know, and it was a big favourite with the fraternity that we might call Skinhead or Suedehead by then, and I'm talking about the first wave, because it came out in 1970. So that was just such a big tune, you know. I mean, retrospectively, I found out that, you know, Holland Dozier Holland were behind it and they just left Motown and set up their own thing. They were still under some strangulated sort of thing with Berry Gordy. So they even wrote that song with someone else under an assumed name. But
I never knew that. I never knew that.
Yeah, I think there's a fella called Ron Dunbar that wrote with them. But they collectively, the three of them, went under the name of S. Wayne or something. I think it's Dunbar Wayne, the songwriting credit. But those three were really Wayne. But I don't know if they had some contract that was still ticking over that gave them an exclusive thing with Motown or something. Yeah.
How did you find school? Did you enjoy it?
It was all right. I was more drawn to sort of art and music and stuff. I think I enjoyed it more the younger I was. When I got to my high school, I found the attitudes there a bit weird. The high school I went to became just a normal secondary modern, but it had been a grammar school. And the year I was in, we were the first people that hadn't earned our place there. We were, and so there was a kind of attitude from the teachers that we've let the scum in. You know, it's like, and they didn't like the fact that they'd been downgraded and they were no longer what they were. And so they thought they were, don't get me wrong, I didn't go to Eton, but they thought they were something that they weren't, you know, and or they wanted to be something that they used to be. And we were the first full-year intake that wasn't grammar school people. And
God, that's harsh, isn't it?
But there was, you felt it as well, you know. And, so I became a bit disenchanted with that. I really loved football, and that was a rugby school. And they tried to convert you when you went there. So even if you thought, okay, I'm waiting for art and I'm waiting for games. Once it was games, you're one of them, like a dirty word, soccer players. We're going to convert you into a rugger player. And it's like, oh, God. You know.
I mean, you mentioned like arts and music were to your interests at school. Was that encouraged?
I suppose it was to a certain extent. Yeah, we had a good art teacher, and the music thing, I think they tried to engage with it, but it seemed to me that anything that was like modern or of this century never made it onto the school concert or it had a struggle to do that. But there were some, you know, there was a couple of music teachers, and they used to let... They had a drum kit in this annex, and they used to let us go there if we could actually play. They'd sort of pick about half a dozen of you and go, yeah, you can play. So you can go in there at break time and do something. And then you got a little bit of a scene going yourself. So that helped school bands flourish a little, but they weren't very encouraging of you playing in a concert. But for some reason, they were people in the sixth form. So... If you would, it was more or less like they're saying, if you stay on here like until you're 18, we might let you play that bloody beat music that you play, you know. And it's just like, right, so I've got to stay on for my A levels. I can't wait to get out of here. I've got to stay on just to get up in front of you lot, you know. And that seemed to be the deal.
Track 4, first song you bought from a record shop, Mick.
It wasn't a new record. I was going through a rack. cheap singles that I could afford. But I remember, so it wasn't Current, but it was Baby Love by the Supremes.
Oh,
and I remember my mum loving that record. I remember it from the radio, and I thought, I recognise that title. And that's the first record I bought. And it was on the Stateside label with the S with a dollar sign.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what... I don't know, pre-65 Motown stuff in the UK come out on Stateside. It didn't have its own label in the UK then. I've since found out. I didn't know then.
Yeah.
I just thought, this is Baby Love. I remember this.
That's a great record for your first record.
Well, it's all right, but I just think that's more about my mum's influence, really, yeah. I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that it was in the cheap box.
And can you remember where you bought it?
It wasn't even a record store. It was a Cubs jumble sale. And my mate just went, they've got loads of records. And I just went, yeah, but the person running them knows what they've got. But they just had this, they were charging too much for albums, I thought. But like they just had these old singles, a couple of boxes of singles, and there were a few treasures there, I thought, you know.
So as you started to grow up, Mick, how important did record shops become for you?
Well, very important, but I always liked singles. I used to try and chat up mates that I thought had richer mums and dads to buy albums that I like and then borrow them off them.
Brilliant.
Which is, you know, it's horrible. But I would prefer to have, you know, 15 singles and 2 albums and by 15 different artists. So I wanted to try and take in a lot of different stuff. I mean, my favourite format, and it probably still is the EP, really.
Mm.
I think you get you know, a bit more out of one band, but it's not as boring as an album if you're not really getting into all of it, you know. I think 4 tracks on a 7 is just felt like a nice thing to me.
Definitely.
So I treasured a few EPs, you know, that I hounded down.
The fact that you said that, you know, you'd rather have sort of 15 singles than two albums. Are you like, if you hear a record and you like it, are you? I'm only asking this because I am. Do you play it over and over and over again?
There are some records like that, and when I was younger, there were records like that. Like, you know, I'm talking about me chatting people up to get albums. My mate Paul Borek, I talked him into buying Dr. Feelgood's first album, and he was really into early Stones. And I went, they're doing a lot of like rhythm and blues, and it's just like, it's sort of almost like mid-60s, but it was like something else as well. And I borrowed that album off him for about 9 months and played it every day. I think that's quite an influential album, actually. I think it influenced so many people with its attitude and its spirit and the image that they come out with.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're talking to an Essex boy here, so we're fiercely proud of them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's the Canby Island thing, isn't it?
As you started to sort of play more and stuff, and you'd get these records, you know, like Feelgoods or whatever it was, would you start to sort of deconstruct them in your head and work out how them records were put together, like the parts of it and that?
Sometimes I would, yeah. I mean, I know that my dad said to me when I was listening to, I had a compilation of rock and roll stuff and rhythm and blues stuff, and he heard me listen to it and just went, of course, you know, all those songs have only got three chords. And I went, hang on, sorry? He went, yeah, they've only got three chords. And once you've worked out what key they're in, that's what makes them so easy to play along with. And I thought, that was like the keys to the universe to me. I just thought, I'm on this, you know.
Yeah.
But it's quite nice because my dad saw something in me then and he just went, I've got a mate that DJs at a pub. He went, I think I'm getting a line into what you're into. You like rhythm and blues and soul. And he came home with like two orange boxes. I used to have them brick big orange boxes that were just the right size for seven-inch singles. And he came home with two of them from work. And he went, I borrowed them from Johnny Alton and I've got to go back. But, you know, my mate Eddie, he's vlogged me a cassette and I don't know where that come from. But so you've got to get them all taped over the weekend. If you like them. And I did do a tape of all these singles and I listened to them all and I played along to them on the piano. And I kind of, there was a lot of New Orleans soul and a lot of Chicago blues. And it was great, you know. You know, this bloke who I never met, who my dad worked with in a warehouse, he was one of my greatest influences, really, you know.
Brilliant. I tell you what I love as well about that kind of doing them sort of mixtapes of different tracks on cassettes, and it's like, and how important them cassettes become. So much so that, like, I've not listened to a cassette for probably 20 years, Mick, but I know sometimes a record comes on the radio and as it finishes I think, oh, I know what's next. And it's like,
yeah, you remember the order of the thing and that it's you've got made that, for you or something.
Yeah,
you've made.
Yeah, that weird muscle memory of like just playing them, because obviously not having everything at my disposal, you cherish what you had. So it would like ingrain itself. And I was thinking, oh, I know what's next. Oh, no, of course it's not next. It's the radio. Like, but that is the you know, the power of them sort of things can have. Yeah. All right, we're going to move forward now to, I guess, your late teens. And for track five, the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing.
There's a few I thought of here, but I've gone with Bus Stop by the Fatback Man.
Nice.
Because that sort of came out in the middle of the 70s, and I was about 16, and I was just about able to get in proper clubs then. There was no ID then, you know. We're talking about such ancient times that to get into a Mecca place, you had to have a tie on, believe it or not. Never mind no hats and trainers. You had to have a tie on. And the thing is, everyone took them off as soon as they got in. And on one occasion, my mate forgot his tie and he just went around the corner and got a knot out of his sock, took his sock off and put it around his neck. And he got in. So it was a bit of a farcical thing, but... So that sort of that track is from that era when I first thought, right, I can get in here. I'm just tall enough. If I wear the right jacket, I'll look all right. But before that, I was going to a lot of discos that were just sort of like, you know, didn't have a license. You'd just get Coke or Fanta and they're playing good records. So there's earlier sort of things that are in my mind that I consider clubbing, but they're not proper clubs, really. So,
what were the tunes, though?
So the tunes from that from earlier on would be like sort of Finders Keepers, Chairman of the Ball, things like that.
Yeah.
Rock Your Baby, George McRae. I don't know, Sex Machine, that just seemed to transcend all eras. I know it came out in 71, but it just like that was one of them records that never went away, you know. And also earlier, sort of like sort of youth club discos, a lot of the sort of reggae stuff, Liquidator and Longshot, yeah. Kick the Bucket and all that sort of, that's coming out the tail end of sort of all the sort of suede head thing. You know.
And then sort of moving forward, you know, and we'll touch on the Style Council here, like, to, you know, because that was a huge success, and I'm just interested, you know, what was their sort of clubbing in and around then? You know, I'm sure it was probably very different to the clubbing that you was doing when you were 16.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the moment you say clubbing with the Style Council, I think of, like, Hold Me Tighter in the Rain by Billy Griffin. Yeah. That was, like, come out just when we started, and we used to just work in the studio till quite late and then go out to places. And that was one of them place then things. And trying to think of other tunes that were around then. I don't know, Love Town and things like that. And there's a lot of good tunes out early 80s, you know.
How did you, because obviously Portwood had success, you know, massive success with The Jam, and being obviously the front person, you know, was a very, very recognisable face. And then the Style Council happened, and obviously you become a very, very recognisable face. How did you find fame? How was it for you? And you know, being able to walk down the street and you know, people recognise you. How is that, and how did you deal with it?
It's all right. It's okay, you know. Everyone thinks you're richer than you are, you know. That's the downside of it. I've seen you on telly.
Do you know what? I was going to say that. That's the thing. It's like the amount of people that, because I'm always fascinated to ask artists like what it was like going on Top of the Pops, because it being such an institution, like growing up watching it, it's the only place you could see your pop stars. And I think it was when I spoke to Bedders from Madness. And I said, how was that first, like, you know, Top of the Pops performance? I think they were doing the Prince or something. He went, yeah, I had to borrow the bus fare home afterwards. And it was like, you just presume then, when you see people on Top of the Pops, that, well, they're definitely like going home on a jet. They're millionaires. Of course they are. They're on Top of the Pops. Like,
yeah. It's a bit of a jolt. I mean, of course, it's a thrill to get there because you've thought about it for a long time, you know. But it's kind of, you're, when you get there, you think, oh, this is really small. And they're just, like, really brutal with the audience, like knocking them about like cattle and just, like, get here and get there. And it's just... And then it just becomes a bit, oh, all right. Well, you're pleased to be there and you think you've achieved something. I mean, the first time I went on there was with a band called the Merton Parkers in 1979.
Oh, you went on there with the Parkers?
Yeah, and I was a pretty cautious person. I had a job in the city. I worked for a shipping agent, and we were on Top of the Pops on the Thursday. I left work on the Friday, and that's a building with like 7 floors, and there was a bar on the 6th floor, and it used to open only on Friday lunchtimes. That Friday lunchtime, I suddenly had 300 new friends, you know, and I thought, I'm leaving in 3 hours, and that's the end of it, sort of thing. It's really odd. Oh, wow.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. For track 6, your favourite song from an artist from your home county, please, Mick.
I was thinking about this. I used to work in a supermarket in Malden, which is the end of the Northern Line. And opposite us was Malden Tube. And then there was a little shoe repairers. And there was a fella in there. And I was told he was a singer. And I thought about that, and many years later, he made a record, and his name was Junior. And so it's Mama used to say. When I got to meet him a few years after, I was only a Saturday boy at that supermarket, I said, were you the fella in the heel bar by Malden Tube? And he went, yeah, that was me. I went, loads of people told me that, and I wasn't sure if it was true. And he just went, yeah. And I said, well, where are you from? And he just went, I think it was from Wandsworth originally, but he said, I live in Mitcham. And I went, whereabouts? He went, near Pollard's Hill. And I went, well, my nan's flat's just there. So it's really funny. And I can't say I watched him a bulb or knew him, but it's just like something in close proximity. And you thought, well, that's great, you know. And, you know, he went on Soul Train and met James Brown. And there's a theory that Michael Jackson might have adapted one of his dance moves because he liked his video and this, that, and the other. And you just think, oh, it's a little fellow that used to work in the Eel Bar at Borden Tube. And that's brilliant. Great. You know, I love things like that.
Did you end up working with Junior at any point?
Yes, he did do, he worked on a thing called the Council Collective.
Yeah.
Where he sung and Jimmy Ruffin sung, and it was a miners benefit record.
That's right.
It was called Soul Deep. Yeah, so that's when I got to see him, and then we did a tour with him. He was on a Red Wedge tour, so yeah. We got to see him quite a lot, so he had a chance to talk about a lot of different things, you know.
Wonderful.
But it was nice to see someone from that close and just sort of think, I mean, when I was a Saturday boy at Caters, I was 15 and he might have been like 16 just working across the road. And it's just lovely to think you can go that far.
Absolutely. Know? Absolutely. Well, you can be DJ Namek for last track. Turn someone onto something that they may not hear. So a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
I'd like them to hear a record called Just Don't Pay by Debbie Taylor. She's a soul singer, and I had the opportunity to work with her about 7 years ago. Me and a few mates that used to do a lot of soul pickup things with different people. We've done Martha Reeves and Candy Staton and people like that. But what's really lovely, we used to go up to a place near Leeds, I think it's Castleford, for a DJ called Dave Box, who's sadly no longer with us. But he was a real educator about not just, I guess, a little bit Northern Soul, but really just classic soul. You know, I don't think he liked to label it Northern Soul. But he brought over a lot of acts just for one night only at, I think it was called the Wilton Ballroom, Soulful Sessions at the Wilton. And Debbie Taylor was one of them. And I did know one of her tunes. I think it was called I Don't Want to Leave You. But Just Don't Pay was my favourite that we played with her. And we got to play with Anne Sexton and Richard Caton and a few other people that are, some people know them, some people know them for one song, but it's great when you engage with all their stuff. And we met Debbie Taylor and she went, well, you know, 5 or 6 years before I did Just Don't Pay, I'd never recorded before, and the first person I recorded for was Isaac Hayes. He wrote a tune for me in like the late 60s. And I'm like, wow.
That'll do.
You know, and it's just these people. I've got so many stories. And you think if the kind of cards have been stacked a different way, you might have been as big as Gladys Knight or something, you know, because you certainly got the voice. So that was a treat. And it's a sort of tribute to Dave Box in a way, because as much as you might think you know about certain things, there's always someone that knows a bit more about a certain specific area of it. And he wasn't a sort of elitist. He was into sharing it and spreading it, you know.
Yeah.
Which was great.
Wonderful. Well, we put together a Spotify playlist and we put all your choices on there and some of the other records that we've, honourable mentions and records that we spoke about. And so that accompanied this podcast. Mick, as we, fingers crossed, find ourselves in some way coming out of the situation that we're in. And I mean fingers crossed because it doesn't look too positive right now. But what are you most looking forward to personally coming out of this and what's coming up professionally?
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to having no restrictions with seeing your family and just socialising and seeing your mates and things that you took for granted. I'm pleased that a few things, I've been doing a few sessions in studios. One of my mates that runs quite a small studio has redesigned his thing so that everyone can be in like a little igloo and you've still got sort of eyesight with each other through camera technology, and so you've got it audio and visual. That's great. Done a few things at his place, my mate Ernie, and I've done stuff at bigger studios as well. I've been back to like Rack Studios, to do a few things. So it seems to me that the world of recording will return sooner. And I'm talking about old school traditional recording. I know I could do it all there with like a laptop or whatever, but I'm kind of trying to stick with what I know best. And that's sort of, there seems like there's a sort of route to that a lot faster than playing gigs. I mean, I'm going to a gig tonight by the Stone Foundation at the Jazz Cafe in Camden. That's a sort of socially restricted thing. And I think the Jazz Cafe can take about 350. And I think they're letting in about 130. So, and I think everyone's got to be at tables regardless of whether you're downstairs or upstairs. But it'd be interesting to see how that works, you know. I guess if you can do nothing else, if people can get away with having a club a third full and stick to certain sort of rules, then maybe that's a stepping stone to the real deal, you know.
Got to keep these venues open, Mick. It's important, well, you know.
Yeah, it's tough, you know. I mean, all this grant and what have you, I get the feeling that's sort of going to go to the Royal Opera Company and a lot of the elites that always get the sort of big handouts, you know, people that are trying to run little places off their own initiative, suddenly they just seem very devalued, you know. But without them sort of places, they're few and far between where live bands can really cut their chops now. And certainly that scene I was talking about on the Northern Line with all the pubs, so many of them have gone.
Yeah.
You're lucky if any of them are still remaining as pubs, let alone places where you have live music.
Definitely,
And so we should learn to cherish these things. And if they're all sort of decimated, I don't know if we're going to come out the other end of this, like in sort of 18 months, where there'll have to be a new boom and people will have to restart things.
And, yeah.
You know.
And documentary coming out soon?
Yes. There's a documentary coming out the end of the month. That's really good. I'm really pleased. I mean, we've not been able to do a proper premiere for it, but you know, this is the reason I'm sort of trying to spout to a lot of people, because I really believe in it. Mark Baxter and Lee have made a really good film. Those things are always fraught with compromise, but I think they've really reflected what the band were about and done a great job, you know. And I think it's could be quite enlightening to people that are sort of not of a certain vintage. And even if you were around then, it might give you a different aspect on what went down, you know. So that's good. Yeah, that's nice. And there's a box set coming out at the same time. So it's like I say, we weren't to know that, but it is a bit of a year for reflection, I suppose. And it's interesting to revisit all those things and
absolutely
see what they might mean to fresh ears.
Mick, it's been lovely having a little nostalgia trip with you today. Wish you all the best, mate. Good luck with the documentary. Yeah. And
all right.
And thanks so much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it.
All right. I hope it all turns out all right in the edit.
Cheers, mate. There you go. Hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got as much fun listening to that as I did chatting to Mick. What an absolute top fella. Really good chat, great taste in music, obviously, and got to talk about some wonderful records. So we'll stick them all on the Spotify playlist, so you can go over there and have a listen. And as mentioned at the beginning, if you enjoyed this chat, then go and have a look in the archives. Hear me chatting to Dennis of Nine Below Zero, The Milk, oh gosh. Who else have I chatted to recently? Recently, let me think. Chuck D from Public Enemy, Mel C from the Spice Girls, Maxine Peake. The list is far and wide. And yeah, just some lovely kind of little snapshots into people's creative journeys and the records that have soundtracked it. And yeah. And I hope you enjoyed this one, and because it was a real privilege to chat to Mick. You can find out about everything to do with this podcast and where you can listen to other episodes, where you can support the Patreon, where you can get merch and everything at www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. Offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'm out of here. I'll see you next time. Thanks ever so much for listening. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk. Official sponsors of Off the Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweater starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.